All right, welcome back to the Baseball America Dynasty Show. This is your host, Jeff Ponce. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Matt Eddy. This week, we have our first guest. Of course, it's the second podcast, but we have our first guest on the show. Welcome a good friend of mine, one of the standouts of the Dynasty and Fantasy Prospect Ranking industry. It's James Anderson of RotoWire. James, welcome to the show. How are you, man?
I'm good, guys. Good to be on with both of you. This will be fun.
Yeah, man. I'm excited. I'm excited to jump into this with you. Welcome onto the show. You've had me on your show many times. I know we've spoke a million times, played in a ton of leagues together. But for those out there that are listening that are less familiar with you and your work, James, why don't you give us sort of your background, how you got into this, and what you do over at RotoWire?
Yeah, I have a journalism degree, and I've been like working at RotoWire in some capacity for about a decade. I kind of started on there just kind of doing a bunch of different stuff, and I got really into, I'd been playing fantasy baseball since my sophomore year of college, but about 8 years ago or so, I started getting really into prospects. And I started kind of just writing up notes on prospects for the site, sort of on my own, and kind of parlayed that into being our main prospect guy. And then eventually got hired full time. And so I've been doing the prospect rankings at the site for about 7 years. It started off as like a top 200. I think it's been a top 400 for about 5 or 6 years now. And it's been a blast. I love doing what I do. I'm really lucky to be able to do it as my job. It's really fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I can appreciate that. And I know that you play in a variety of leagues. You play in the Devil's Rejects League with Matt Eddy and myself. And Matt, I'm gonna kick it over to you. We're starting out with the Devil's Rejects throwback draft here. I know you picked pretty high. Weren't able to reacquire Brock Wilkin, who you threw back into the pool. What are your big takeaways so far in this throwback draft this year?
Yeah, this draft is crazy. I had a terrible team last year, and still am picking just 7th out of 20. I let a number of prospects go who I would like to reacquire, and the one I did reacquire was Colton Montgomery of the White Sox. I was hoping Jay Allen would fall to number 7 overall, but that didn't happen. And as you noted, Brock Wilkin, the Wake Forest third baseman, he didn't make it back to me either. But that's okay.
I put in the call too, man. I called Wilkin last weekend, and I was like, Brock, you got to get your K rate up to 30%, so that way Matt Eddy can reacquire you in the Devil's Rejects. And he said, bro, I got you, no problem. one of the reasons I brought that up, though, is James is in it, made an announcement last week regarding another dynasty league that he's heading up and putting together right now with Ian Kahn, another friend of the show, with The Athletic, does great dynasty work. You know, one of the better players that I've played with over the years. Also, Jesse Roach from Baseball Perspective, another tremendous player. And then Brett Sayre from Baseball Prospectus. The name of the league I love, it's the Highlander Dynasty League, which brings me back to like being 13 years old and going to Blockbuster Video and randomly renting like movies like the Highlander. So James, why don't you fill us in a little bit there? Because I thought it was a really interesting setup in terms of like how keepers were handled and some of that stuff, which might be a little different from what our listeners are typically used to.
Yeah, this was kind of a brainchild of Brett Sayers. He and I both have experience commissioning quote-unquote expert dynasty leagues, and we've kind of been frustrated by how difficult it is to sort of keep those leagues sustainable, because the way that dynasty is played, if you don't have a full league of smart competitive managers, things can quickly tilt in the direction of a handful of teams. Managers often end up kind of losing interest, especially when there's not a financial commitment involved. So these leagues that we've been in where, you know, it's just for pride, you know, kind of like a dynasty version of like a Tout Wars or later, those types of industry leagues that they're on for a long time. The leagues that are just for pride, when it's dynasty, in my experience, those tend to kind of fail or end up being pretty lopsided leagues after 3 or 4 years. And a lot of people that produce dynasty content aren't actually good dynasty players necessarily. You know, anyone can produce the content, right? Like it's a different thing to be actually good at playing the game. And so what we did was, and this was really all Brett. He kind of had all these cool ideas for just mechanisms in the Constitution that make it very difficult for any team to really separate themselves over the span of like 3 or 4 years. Obviously, you could still put together a team that's going to be very competitive for a while, but there are just all these sort of, it's kind of a waterfall keeper structure is the way that he describes it, where every team keeps a handful of guys and then there's a redistribution draft, you know, like a one round redistribution draft, and people keep another handful of guys and then there's another redistribution draft. So you're not going to be able to keep like your 20 best players year to year. You'll be able to keep a good chunk of those players, but there's just all these different mechanisms in the Constitution. It's quite complicated. I think the best way to understand it is to read the Constitution that's available on my Twitter and on Brett Sayer's Twitter, Jesse's, Ian's. We ended up taking applications for that league and we got 120 applications. And so that was a really, you know, nice kind of feedback for us, just that so many people wanted to be in the league. And it allowed us to really kind of get down to a bunch of owners that we thought would be great. And we still haven't finalized everything yet, but the whole point was to start a league full of people that create dynasty content and are also really good players and really want to be in the league. There is a buy-in. It's $100, but 50% of that buy-in goes to the league winner's charity of their choice every year. So that's kind of a cool wrinkle as well. I'm really excited about it. I think the draft will probably get underway here in about a week or so. I mean, we don't have much time, obviously, with opening day right around the corner. It's been fun, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the thing, you know, I had applied myself. I haven't heard back yet, regardless of what comes of that. I'm really excited to sort of follow along, simply because I thought that some of the stipulations that you mentioned were almost like franchise tags, but they were like different sort of silos for, we'll say, different players at different points in career, prospects, guys who get forced up, all that sort of stuff. And I thought that was a really interesting wrinkle because it almost made you make decisions the way a major league team would. For an expansion draft or, you know, for the Rule 5 and some of those things that you had to sort of manage your roster and then look a few years down the road. I want to take that and sort of jump into our next part of the discussion, more of a general discussion between the three of us. I just finished my first time doing a full dynasty rank. I've done prospect ranks, you know, on the real baseball side and then, of course, on the fantasy side for years now. But I've never really put all of my rankings with MLB and all that sort of thing together. I know you've done that before. You have a lot of experience with it. You know, Matt's certainly done it for, you know, his internal purposes for leagues and that sort of thing. But the question that I think I tackled at the beginning and then tried to work off of was like, what's the window that I'm focusing on here from a value perspective? Because when you look at Dynasty, and I did some Open Universe stuff, you could look at it from a 2-year window all the way out to like 7-8 years if you really wanted to. I felt like I focused on a 3-year window you know, I tried to take the numbers that I could get, even if it was like Zips projections for, you know, for 22, 23, 24, kind of value that a little bit and just look at different things. So I try to focus on like a 3-year window when I put my rankings together. How do you guys look at it? I'll go to James first and then over to Matt. Like, when you're going into a dynasty draft, like, what's the window that you're really trying to, you know, cram all of your talent into?
Well, if I'm putting together a set of rankings, I'm trying to do the rankings as if it's for a healthy dynasty league that I expect to be around for more than 3 years. But I mean, the way that I rank like prospects, for instance, you know, open universe prospects, I don't rank them, but if I did, I'm always going to put a major emphasis on how close they are to the majors. And I think that that's going to translate into how confident you are in them being an everyday player or being a rotation pitcher. So, I mean, I think proximity is always going to be stressed whenever I'm ranking prospects. And then, you know, the better the player, the more likely I am to expect them to hold their skills, you know, into their 30s. So I never had like a, you know, strict, like these are for the next 3 years type of thing in mind. It's kind of more fluid and more player dependent, type of player dependent. But I mean, these are really tricky to put together, as you know. I mean, I can't even imagine doing what you did, Jeff, with a 1,000 players open universe. Like that would honestly probably take me months to do and to get it to the point where I felt good enough about it to publish it. So I mean, these rankings are extremely tricky. And the thing that I think makes it so tricky is that in the dynasty league, there's just going to be all kinds of different teams that are looking for different things, right? Like you have your win now teams that are going to trade any teenage prospect. They're going to trade them for something that's going to help them win now. And you have your rebuilding teams where, you know, any 30-year-old big leaguer who is still kind of in their prime or near their prime, they're going to be trying to flip that guy for young talent. And then you have your teams that are kind of in the middle where, you know, maybe they're going to be able to contend the following year. And so they're trying to kind of get that stable talent, get their holes sort of filled on the position player side and make sure that they have the horses to make a run the next year and stuff like that. So it's tough because you're trying to cater these rankings to a bunch of different teams with different strategies and competing interests.
Yeah, agree there. And I think, you know, that's the thing when it comes to dynasty rankings, drafting a dynasty team, is you gotta come up with a focus and how you're going to approach it ahead of time. You know, some of the stuff is always room dependent, but, you know, like you said, you know, there's different ways to look at it. There's guys that go all in and they more or less build a redraft team and, you know, maybe backfill with prospects later on in the draft. There's others. And I always think about, you know, Tom Trudeau has kind of became like his, his go-to build, but like, you know, there was a period like 2017, 18, 19, I can remember doing a ton of drafts with Tom, and it was just, you know, he'd draft the top prospects and young players, like guys under 23 years old, his first 15, 16 picks. And a lot of the time, because he's a great trader, it would work out. I don't think I can do that because I don't think that's that plays to my strengths necessarily, especially considering I try to avoid carrying too many prospects because I can get very prospect huggy. So that said, Matt, you've been doing this for a long time. You have experience, you know, building different types of fantasy leagues and that sort of thing. I know, some of the stuff that you've done, like the Ontano leagues and that sort of thing, are a little bit more in depth in terms of some of the other factors you got to think about. So that in mind, I wanted to sort of kick it over to you. And how do you look at that window when you're at the draft table and you're putting together your rankings and values?
Yeah, you guys raise a lot of good points. I think proximity is the number one consideration for me. I mean, especially if you're trying to win in year one, you have to get the pitchers because it's so difficult to get pitching depth by any other means. You know, reliable, durable, effective starting pitchers are one of the rarest and most valuable commodities And, you know, and then I don't mind placing an emphasis on major leaguers and advanced minor leaguers, because I'm pretty comfortable choosing from the lower rungs of the minor leagues to fill out a farm system. So I, you know, in terms of a startup draft, I'm always kind of prioritizing the value over the next 3 years. You know, and before we continue, we should promote that it's the VA Dynasty 1000 is Jeff's 1100 player deep ranking of Dynasty players, including Open Universe players.
Yes, and James, it did take me over a month to put that together.
that's crazy, man.
And it was the kind of thing where even the last minute, and even now I'm looking at it, and like, of course, we put it out, and, you know, hours later, the CBA gets ratified, and all these moves have happened over the last week, so I've been updating organizations for everybody. But the tricky thing is, like, now I have a list of, like, 20 guys that I want to re-rank based on all these situational things that have happened over the last week, you know. Not anything substantial, but it's like, oh, man, it's going to be a bear to maintain. But it's worth it. I can jump in at night and just change it. So it's like, it's not a big deal. But yeah, you know, it's one of those things that, like you said, it's a process. But I guess that kind of leads me to my next question. I didn't put this on the slot, but is there an age group or sort of like range where you're like, I'm out? Like, is it 32? Is it 33? Is it 34? I found myself more and more recently being less scared off of guys that could retire in 2 or 3 years. Because sometimes, especially in leagues where there's a keeper element to it, it's an easy cut, right? Like, if you're like, all right, this guy is, you know, like Nelson Cruz in 2 years isn't going to be playing baseball any longer. He's a much easier cut, you know, than somebody who's whatever, you know, 31 or 32 coming off of a bad year. It's like, all right, it's or even a young prospect. Like, it's easy to make that decision and just be like, all right, well, he's not playing any longer. Like, I feel like there's some value in that. I learned that from the TDBCs that I did with Prospects Live, frankly. But is that something, like, is there a point in the drafts where you feel like there's some value for older players? It's like, you know, after pick whatever, 160, 170, 200, 250, is there a breaking point on certain guys, James?
I generally just try to have, like, there be kind of a theme to my roster. And, you know, you mentioned Devil's Rejects that we're both in. Like Eno and I on our team have Justin Verlander, Charlie Morton. We just drafted Corey Kluber in that league. So, you know, when you have like one of those guys, or a couple of those guys, I don't think there's anything wrong with just kind of loading up guys who might only have a couple of years left, because you're obviously trying to win in the present, and you know that those guys are not going to be worth much of anything in a couple of years, but you know, it kind of makes sense in that type of build. But I'm also I have other teams where probably my entire roster is 30 or younger, and I'm trying to kind of hit on players in their, like, you know, age 23, age 24 season that could break out and become, you know, top 150 players and guys that I can build around. And I'm not a very active trader in dynasty leagues. Like, I, you know, I'll pull off a handful of moves per year, probably in each league, but it doesn't appeal to me to, like, if I have a really young core, like ending up with a guy like Nelson Cruz or a guy like Justin Verlander, because, like, I'm just not going to be that active in trying to flip that player. And so I would rather kind of target similarly valued players who are younger that can just be on my team for a long time. But I mean, I think you definitely gotta take it sort of team by team basis.
Yeah, and I think that's a big part of it, you know, obviously, is, you know, if you're skewing really young, you're taking Julio and Bobby Witt and, you know, young prospects, guys that are just on the cusp of the major leagues, you know, with your early picks in a startup dynasty league, then yeah, it probably doesn't make sense. But, you know, if you're skewing more toward late 20s, early 30s, then yeah, I mean, it comes to a point where it's like, that guy's going to help me win this year and next year. And, you know, there's obviously tremendous value in that. Also buys you a couple years if you have a, if you have a minor leagues to backfill, stash a guy you hold on to that you feel can be, you know, a potential contributor, especially when a guy's a utility, right? Like there's some value and flexibility to that. The next question I wanted to jump into here, and I feel like I'll go last, but I have like two very specific types of players that I've gravitated toward over the last couple of years, particularly on the hitting side. But I'm interested as to like, are there types of players, like a power and speed guy, a hit tool guy, are there types of players that you gravitate toward? I'll go over to Matt first on this one. Just in terms of, you know, I find myself, not that it's all your teams, but like when I take a step back, it feels like I definitely gravitate toward prospects that are like this, or hitters, that young hitters that are like this, because I feel that they can develop into this.
Yeah, I've been burned so many times by the power speed players that I tend to avoid them if possible and emphasize more plate discipline metrics with power, you know, power production or power indicators. So I prefer middle of the field players, especially when they're younger, because they can fan out to the corners. I definitely gravitate more toward plate discipline, hitting ability with power potential and projection.
Which makes a lot of sense. James, is there a type that you find yourself going after?
I echo a lot of what Matt said. I remember I did like a startup draft a couple of years ago where I sort of had it as a rule that I was going to be taking, when I was taking hitters, I was going to be taking hitters under 28 years old and guys who I thought were quality defenders, guys that were going to add value with their glove, to try to buy them that developmental time and buy them those point appearances. And, you know, I gravitate towards like Brian Rocchio types. I'm sort of almost trying to find like the next, you know, the next Mookie Betts, the next Ozzie Albies, the next Bo Bichette, like those sort of, you know, 6 foot, 5'11", up the middle, really, really good hit tool, a little bit of power, a little bit of speed, maybe can grow into power that might not be present at the time that you're drafting them. Those are the types of guys that I tend to end up with a lot of. You know, the guys that are going to strike out a lot. It's not like I'm not going to pick those guys up if I see a guy breaking out, you know, in the lower levels or something like that, or even like, you know, a Joey Weimer type. You know, I'm not going to be like, oh, I'm not going to pick him up because he strikes out a lot, but I'm not going to prioritize that type of player early in the draft.
Yeah, and I know that we had some conversations offline about this, talking about Austin Martin in particular. I think last week we had talked a little bit about Louis Matos, kind of similarly, in the sense that it's like those advanced hit tools, those guys that have advanced approach like Martin has, and it's kind of like the last piece to the puzzle is adding, we'll say even like average 50 pop, where it's like with all these other supporting skills and the fact that, you know, Martin might be a shortstop, probably a center fielder, maybe a third baseman, maybe he's a utility guy, but he's going to play like a valuable position. Like he's not a left field only first base guy that's going to get pushed to DH. And then you have to worry about how he fits in the puzzle. I thought that was, you know, really the point that you made there, that it's like, there is value in guys that fit into a defensive role because they got to get into the lineup every day, and defensive value buys you opportunity even when you're struggling, you know, and that's so big for young players that come up. I mean, we have to think about, you know, the number of great superstars, future MVPs in the history of the game, not even just recently, not even the cliche Mike Trout struggled when he first came up. Dustin Pedroia struggled for a month when he first came up, and people wanted Alex Cora to play. And then, you know, by the end of that season, he was rookie of the year, then an MVP the following year. And I mean, that's just, you know, an example from 15 years ago. And there's been a numerous guys like that since. So I think that, you know, that is a really great point, because you need guys that are going to be able to get in the lineup. There's real baseball elements to this that do matter. Following along on that stuff is true. And I agree. I feel like the guys that I've gravitated toward more recently, it's less the power guys, it's less the speed guys. It's more like, what's the hit tool like? Do they chase? Do they make a high rate of contact? And is there some power projection there? Like Xavier Edwards is a, you know, really good hit tool guy. He's got speed, probably going to be a fine second baseman every day, but there's little chance that he's going to develop enough power for him to really hit for impact. And I think that like, that's the extreme end of the scale, but there's a lot of other guys that sort of fall into that window. Robert Hassel is a really good example of a guy that, you know, has all the other elements. He has some defensive value, but in a few years, as that power starts to develop, he can take that next step. And as you said, I think those are the guys that ultimately develop into superstars. So it's good points there. You know, absolutely.
There's another consideration in that shortstop, second base, center field tend to be young man positions in the major leagues, as successful teams will push older players to corners. So you definitely, that defensive value does equate there too.
Yeah. And that's one of those things that I don't think we probably even bring up. I don't even think I necessarily consider that, but it's true. It's guys age, they move to those corner positions. They might have, you know, weightier contracts. They might be veterans and leaders on those teams. So they're not going away. They're not getting DFA'd. They're probably too good for that. But there's areas where, you know, defensively they've slowed down and they can move. That's kind of what's happening with Mike Trout now, right?
I was just going to say, we have the example in Anaheim with Marsh and Trout. Yes.
You know, and no one's going to say that Brandon Marsh is the better offensive player, obviously. No questions there. Next one I wanted to sort of bring up, I'll go to James first on this one. There's a sea of prospects and veterans out there. How do you equate the value of prospects among veterans? I felt like that was the trickiest thing, even more so than like the open universe stuff. It's easy to kind of, like, it's easy for me to weigh like Dylan Cruz when I watch him versus an A-ball, you know, right fielder or center fielder, because it's like, all right, like I think Cruz could do that, probably do it another level above, where, you know, when you're talking about a really exciting, prodigious hitter at 19 years old versus, you know, a 27 or 28 year old vet that maybe has some signs of, you know, he's going to be on the downswing in the next couple of years. Like, how do you weigh that? What are the things that you're looking at? And, you know, is it an innate gut thing, or are there certain metrics of stuff that you're looking at and trying to weigh the two?
You know, I love ranking prospects. Like updating my top 400 prospect rankings is my favorite part of my job. Doing the dynasty rankings is honestly probably my least favorite part of my job for this exact reason. And I a couple of years ago, I sort of instituted a rule on my prospect rankings where guys who sign as international free agents who are over the age of 24 are not eligible for my prospect rankings, because I just am not going to rank, say, a Suzuki next to a bunch of prospects, because I just think it's apples to oranges. Now with the dynasty rankings, it's, you know, a lot of it is just kind of put yourself in the shoes of the contending team and the rebuilding team, and think about, you know, if I'm trading like Nick Castellanos and I'm looking for a prospect, you know, who's the prospect, like what range of prospect am I willing to accept for that veteran hitter? And then hopefully you can maybe kind of slot those guys in like kind of amongst each other, sort of like a cluster of veterans that you would trade for a grouping of prospects. I mean, that's really kind of the best way you can do it. It's just, it's so imperfect. And during like early years of the pandemic, I did a set of rankings for rebuilding teams and for contending teams. And I thought that that was a lot easier to kind of put together. If you just did a set of dynasty rankings from the view of a team that's trying to win over the next year or two, and then you just did a set of dynasty rankings from a team that's trying to contend in like 3 years, those are a lot easier to put together, because there's sort of a theme and a common set of values that you're looking for. But just doing those general dynasty rankings, I mean, it's so tough. And you know, you're never going to be sort of happy with the finished product. Like, you know, I could go in and do a set of rankings and then look at it 24 hours later and want to change a bunch of stuff. You know, it's just, it's never going to feel complete or perfect. And, you know, it just kind of is what it is.
That's my favorite part about doing the dynasty rankings, is looking at it like 24 or 48 hours after I like really felt really good about something and I reviewed it 12 times and then shot it over to like, you know, whoever, my trusted circle, and then go back to it 2 days later and be like, what the heck was I thinking here? Like, why is this guy here? He needs to move down like 50 or 60 spots. I looked at it yesterday and I was like, why? Like, I was looking at my rankings and I was like, why is Andrew McCutchen inside the top 500? Like, what was, and it's like, you're constantly readjusting. So yeah, I think that's,
I'll put it up on the site and then I'll have like an article to go with it. And one of the, you know, commenters will be like, why do you have this guy at this spot? And I'll just be like, nope, you're right. Like, he shouldn't be there. He should be over here. Like, you know, I had
Matt to help me out there where he shot me over a bunch of names and he was like, hey, what about this guy? What about this guy? And then I had done like a sleeper rank and was like, hey, I got to.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Why do I use Indeed for our hiring at Baseball America? Because it takes so much of the busy work out of hiring and does it for me. I can find highly qualified candidates in one place, set up interviews, and communicate with them all on Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualification and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So you use Indeed. As you use it more, the better it gets. And listeners to this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Make sure that these guys are ranked, you know, aggressively within my rankings if I'm going to hype them up. So I adjusted some of those ranks before it went live too. So I totally get that. That's a difficulty. And then Matt, before we move on to the next one, I wanted to sort of ask you too, like, you know, you got some experience with this too. So like, how are you weighing prospects versus veterans, whether it's at the draft table or, you know, assessing it for trades? And I know a lot of it obviously is going to be specific to your current build and, you know, your competitive window with a specific team.
Yeah, you know, I'm on the same page with you guys. I think you got to go for proximity or you got to go for absolute upside.
Yeah, I think, you know, ultimately that's what it is. You have to, there's no half measures really. It's really tough to be like, I'm going to have a competitive team and also have like a really young, good core. Mm-hmm. Like I feel like I did that when I built that RDI draft and like, it set me back for like a year and a half. And then I got really lucky in 2020 that a bunch of guys like were performing. And then I traded, this is a great one. It was Ray Butler and I managed this team, and I traded Wander Franco for Keston Hira. I didn't want to do it. And Ray was like, we need to do it. We're competitive. We can finish in the top three. I think we finished fourth, honestly. I can't remember. But we made that trade, and like a year later, I was like, thank God that league collapsed, because otherwise, like, I would have had to own that, and that's not fun.
That's, I mean, you gotta, like, that league, like, I was the commissioner of that league, and I decided to fold it, but like that league's a great example of you know, why you should value proximity. It, like, it, just kind of get a read of, like, is this league likely to be around for 10 years? Is it likely to be around for 5 years? Because Tom Trudeau did that all prospect strategy in that league, and it folded before he was even close to, like, you know, putting it all together, right? So he basically wasted 3 years on that strategy and never got to see it out. You know, I think obviously you would you certainly would regret that Franco Hura trade long term, but, you know, maybe Ray was right in the idea of, you know, let's get this guy who could help us right now. You know, maybe the evaluation on Hura was wrong, but maybe the idea, the process was solid.
Yeah, and I think it was who was available and all that too. So there was an element of that there. But yeah, and I think on the opposite side, I swear, I think it was Ian Khan that I had spoke with a year ago, where he was talking about some big money dynasty league that him and Brett entered. And there was like a substantial buy-in and everybody tried to get a rebuilding team. And his approach to it was like, we had all these prospects that were just falling down the board and guys that, you know, potentially could have contributed within a year or so for his team. And he's like, do you think it's like, that's the approach? And it honestly seems like sometimes, you know, that's one of those situations where you read the room and you kind of look at it and you go, this is, you know, this is what the market inefficiency is here. It's like, there's, because everyone's so trying to win, they're so concerned about getting their money back, that maybe they're letting a lot of talent and the opportunity to build a really good foundation that, you know, projects well for 3, 4, 5 years of sustainable success, that, you know, sometimes it's better to take that step back and then rebuild, which, you know, I don't think you always necessarily see that, because there's rarely that big of a money buy-in element. And I think that's goes back to some of the point that you had mentioned earlier of, like, you know, the pride element of dynasty, and it's a longer strategy, and just for whatever reason, it doesn't get the competitive nature that you get in like a Tout Wars or a Labor or some of those other leagues where it is, you know, industry specific and heavily focused on what you can do. Last one I'm going to mention here, sort of in the general dynasty discussion before we go to some quick hitter stuff. New rule changes, universal DH is one of them. Another one is the shifting rules. Has that impacted values for you guys? I'll go over to Matt first. Has that impacted values for you guys on particular players, or is it not?
Oh, yeah, for sure. It opens up roughly, I think, 9,000 plate appearances for position players in the National League. I mean, that's going to have a pretty huge effect on playing time projections. So, you know, and conversely, it does raise the ERA standard in the league a little bit. So you no longer get such a surplus value from National League starters.
Unless you're in the NL Central, and then you get significant surplus value because you have the Pirates and the Reds. And
I was going to say that. Yeah, those front offices should be fired in St. Louis and Milwaukee if they don't make the playoffs with six teams.
Oh, I think I hear that every single year from the Cardinals fans, Matt Thompson in particular. But James, you're a Brewers fan, so this is good for you. But what are your takeaways on the new rule changes? And are there any players that come to mind that you're willing to share that you feel get a value boost, whether it's the DH or even on the shifting side, maybe both?
You know, the shifting element, I haven't really factored that in yet, just because I just want to see how it sort of evolves. Like, I don't think we can really know with any kind of certainty how much it's going to help or hurt the value of players until it's actually implemented. Obviously, I think, you know, Matt nailed it with slight downgrade to NL starting pitchers across the board. Like, to me, I'm kind of thinking of, you know, who are the top 20 or so designated hitters in the game. And I'm just going to kind of assume that within the next year or so, they're all going to sort of find their way into everyday playing time. And I think a really good example of that is the two guys in New York, Dominic Smith and JD Davis. Mm-hmm. I think it might not happen right away this season. Obviously, they still have Robinson Cano there. You would have loved for them to have, you know, made a move to free one of those guys up, or maybe both of them up after the lockout. Still kind of waiting on that. But I think like JD Davis is just too good of a hitter against righties and lefties to be stuck in this sort of like 300 plate appearance role. Now that there are 30 DH slots across baseball, I have to believe that there's going to be a way for him to get involved in kind of more of like a 550 plate appearance range within the next year or so. So like when I'm doing a set of dynasty rankings, I'm not necessarily focused on, you know, there's no playing time for him on opening day of 2022. I have to believe there's going to be playing time for him within the next year or so. And that, you know, there's a handful of other guys like that. The Marlins sort of had the Garrett Cooper, Jesus Aguilar sort of logjam. I think that kind of frees that up a little bit. There's teams like the Dodgers where you probably just don't assume they're going to go with a steady DH because they just have too much talent. There are too many guys that need at bats, so they're trying to cycle guys in and out. I mean, I think that's what most of the very best teams are going to do, is they're just going to use the DH spot as a way to get guys rest. But on some other teams, it is going to be kind of an obvious, like this guy clearly just put him in the DH slot, forget about it. And it's great having 15 more of those.
I will say that this kind of contradicts something that we said a few minutes ago, but it probably boosts some of those positionless guys that can hit in the minor leagues a little bit more. There's more opportunity for those guys. I still think that they're up against it a little bit. This is the point that I was going to make, that it has me boosting a lot of guys that maybe were like utility players and were filling into a bunch of different positions. It now opens that up. I think the Dodgers are probably a good example where now there's this other spot that guy can see, you know, let's say he was going to see 350 to 400 plate appearances anyway. Maybe now he sees above 500, and that can be a significant boost in value, especially when we're talking about counting stats and that sort of stuff. When we're, you know, calculating out roto values and that sort of thing. Interesting. All right. I think those are all good topics. Let's wrap it up here. We don't want to keep you too much longer, James. We appreciate that you came on. I gave some of these some silly names. These are some prospect questions. They're not really great names, but it's just kind of, you know, going off of last year. I'm going to call this one the Prado Melendez Award. James, and I'll go over to Matt. Name a prospect that you like as a bounce back after a rough 2021 season. James, you're first on the hot seat.
Yeah, so, you know, I mentioned this to you guys sort of off air, but I think this is just going to be tough, right? Because the whole idea behind it being Nick Prado and Ben Melendez thing is nobody's going to see this player coming, most likely. Number scouting, stat scouting gets a bad rap, but if you're going to be a really good big league hitter, chances are you're not going to face a ton of resistance in the minor leagues. And so I think that for the most part, like I was looking through my top like 200 or so prospects, most of them had pretty solid years in the minors last year, especially the hitters. But I'm going to go with Pedro Leon with the Astros. And last year was his first season in pro ball stateside. So, you know, having a bounce back year just from his 1 year, maybe doesn't quite fit the spirit of this question, but I just think he's going to be better this year at AAA than a lot of people expect he will be. There was just a lot kind of going on context-wise with him last year. He obviously had a ton of rust to knock off, having not played in competitive games for multiple years before last season. He gets sent to Double A, where the pitching is pretty solid. Had a really, really rough first like 6 weeks or so. Then he really started hitting his stride. had a really nice 6-7 weeks. Then he suffered an injury, was bad at AAA, was mediocre in the Arizona Fall League. I mean, he took his walks. I think he had like a 360 OBP there. But in general, I don't think he impressed many people in the Arizona Fall League. But I'm still a believer in Pedro León being an everyday player for the Astros. I think his swing, his pull side power is just a perfect fit in Houston. I think you can kind of follow that Altuve Bregman path as a guy that gets more out of his power with the Astros than he would in another organization. And then he's a good runner. He can play multiple positions. So I think there's still a lot to like there, even though I know a lot of scouts, a lot of people that are ranked for Dynasty are down on him right now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, everything that you said is true. He started really rough, came on over, just about 2 months, then suffered an injury. I think the other thing, too, you mentioned the time off, the rust there, the somewhat aggressive assignment and the expectations. He also played, you know, two difficult positions. He was split in time between shortstop and center field. And all the elements that go along with that. It's kind of interesting as to, how he shakes out. He didn't look good for me in AFL. He was passive at times. He missed on a lot of stuff in zone, but it's a long season. He was coming off of an injury. So that's a good one. Yeah. I don't think there's anything wrong with that one at all. Matt, I'm going to go over to you. Do you have a breakout?
Yeah. I like that pick by James. I focused my search on upper level guys. I identified a couple of AAA center fielders who I think have more upside to reach. Christian Pache with Oakland now, I think free of the expectations, that he had with the Braves and getting some new voices, change of scenery. I think he's a good bet to realize more of his potential. And Leody Tavares of the Rangers, just the plate discipline metrics are strong. He started to show a little bit late in the year last year. Those would be two guys I would be expecting more from.
Yeah, I like both of those for sure. And Leody was kind of funny. It was like you completely write the guy off after it felt like he was overranked for years. And now he's going to pop back up and, remind you that, hey, there's talent here. I could be something. And there's opportunity there too. So I'm interested there. Yeah, right. The one that I'm going to throw out there is JJ Bleda had a terrible season last year. I don't think that there's any way to sort of justify it in any way, shape, or form. But I will say, dig into some of the underlying metrics, the plate discipline, the contact, some of that stuff wasn't so bad. What I saw in the AFL for a week, he hit for power. He showed it in batting practice. I know that there was some stuff, some adjustments that he made with, timing and stuff in the swing. I know the other thing is he never drives the ball like up the middle of the field, which I know a couple of scouts had brought up to me in conversations we were watching him. One of the funny ones was we were saying that he goes like, it wasn't like pole to pole power. It was like pole and pole power. Like he either goes like tight pull side or he goes like tight opposite field, like nothing in the middle of the field, which is kind of strange, it's almost as if he's either behind or a little bit ahead. But I think a lot of it was timing. I wonder how much of it was Pensacola. I think people got to keep this in mind. That's a ballpark that is in the middle of the ocean. It is surrounded by water on three sides. From what I've heard from guys that have played there, a couple of hitters that were there this year within the Marlins organization and some pitchers that I've spoke with over the last month or two, that there is some fluky stuff with wind patterns on any given day. So, if it's the kind of thing where it's consistently blowing in from right field, a pull side power guy like Bleda could potentially knock down some of those drives. So I know Royce Lewis was another guy that struggled tremendously when he was in Pensacola, went to the AFL and was similar to JJ Bleda, where he had this great season. Let's hope that Bleda doesn't have the same injury luck that Lewis had following that breakout at the AFL, but he's a guy that still has defensive value. I think the Marlins need a guy like this and has some proximity. He spent a full season in AA. The Marlins are kind of on the precipice of being competitive. There's some competitive elements, but they certainly need you know, more strength in that lineup, more power, and somebody that could develop into an everyday guy, you know, even if it's just a 50 corner outfielder, I think there's some value in that. So based on where he's sort of dropped down to, I feel like Blade could bounce back a little bit.
I like your point about Pensacola. I saw a game there in 2017 when the Reds were calling Pensacola home, and it was Nick Senzel versus Mike Soroka that day. So it was a fun game to be at. But I mean, it's an absolutely beautiful park with the ocean in the background there. But yes. I mean, yeah, I think it's very wise to kind of point that out with regards to both the day and with Lewis.
I asked Marlins people about it. I asked a couple of other coaches about it that were with the organization, and they kind of poo-pooed it. I don't think anybody necessarily wanted to address it, but I honestly would be just interested to see if there's like power alleys there. If, you know, I know Burdick didn't have a bad season there, but it's like, hey, if you hit the ball to, you know, left center, you'll get the carry there. But if you're hitting the ball to right center, then you're definitely not, you know, the wind comes in off of whatever. Like this, some of those elemental things, I think, are always stuff that gets overlooked with certain parks and things like that. I know it was like with Julio in like Arkansas, you know, it's a really bad park for like right-handed power. I know people bring up his home run totals, and I always kind of wonder like how much of a factor was that into some of those numbers. You know, stuff is fluky. I think sometimes like that's the stuff with number scouting that can get, you know, a little tricky, is like how different is, you know, 30 points of slug or, you know, 15 extra base hits if, you know, there was some other factor in there that we can't, even the pitching in a given league, it's tough to measure some of that stuff. Next question I want to throw out there, it's a little bit different, but sort of a younger prospect. Is there a guy, I'll throw over to Matt first, that you feel is going to be a breakout this year? Didn't have a bad year, but maybe somebody that you feel is going to jump from maybe outside the top 100 into the top 100, somebody that's maybe off the radar entirely that jumps into the top 250, could even be someone at the back of a top 100 that you think could jump into a top 50. So Matt, I'll send that one over to you. Who's your breakout for 2022?
I'm really intrigued by what James Triantos can do. The Cubs shortstop, good debut in Arizona, kind of a less heralded draft prospect, but one with some late helium. Good athlete, two-way player, although his position is in question in pro ball. But I like what we've seen so far and some of what we've heard from scouts and read. I like him. Evan Carter of the Rangers would be another potential younger breakout prospect guy, because he just has the potential for the five tools.
Yeah. Great plate discipline too. Nobody takes as many pitches in the minor leagues as Evan Carter did. If you get rid of some of that passivity too, it's one of those things where it's like you could see the power and some of the impact start to come. So James, I'll kick it back over to you. Who's your breakout guy for 2022?
I'll go with another Cub and say Kevin Alcantara. He's a guy that I was sort of late to buy in on. I kind of had a bias against him due to his height, and you know, he hadn't really wowed anyone in 2019 with anything he did on the field. Obviously was out of sight, out of mind in 2020. And he was one of the older, you know, super legitimate prospects in the Arizona Complex League last year. Usually those guys are, you know, a young 18. He was an old 18, and I believe he turned 19 in July. But I just think he looks the part. Like, the more video I watch of him, the more impressed I am. And there's always going to be some swing and miss there, I think. But he's the type of guy where, you know, send him to low A. If he's striking out around 25% of the time or better, I think he's going to put up some pretty impressive numbers. So I could see him climbing well inside my top 50. And then just a quick bonus one for someone who might be out there in some leagues. I think Ricky Benasco is going to break out on the pitching side in his first year back from Tommy John surgery with the Rangers.
Yeah, and we've heard similar stuff from the Rangers organization that, you know, Benasco is a guy that's come up in trades and they've been less interested in potentially moving him or trading him. I'm going to give a younger one here, a guy that I had gotten good reports from my good friend Joe Drake, who's now with the Orioles, but Kalai Rosario, who was Twins 2020 fifth round draft pick out of high school in Hawaii, actually. And he had a really interesting year. The numbers weren't bad in the FCL. 277, 341, 452. Strikes out a little bit. There's definitely some swing and miss, but it's not the kind of thing that I think is going to kill his game. He's got plus raw power. The underlying metrics on his power numbers are really good. And if we remember a lot of those FCL parks and spring training parks are typically not great for power outside of Dunedin. So I think that, you know, that sort of plays into this too, that I think, you know, had he been in a better hitting park, the numbers might have been even better. There's definitely some swing and miss there, but it's kind of on the line of being passable. He's fringe average. He's just below average. He rarely chases. He makes good decisions on the pitches he does go after. Not great to see anybody striking out at 30% on the complex. But I do think some of that stuff, you know, the fact that he was so young, this was his first case or his first taste of professional baseball because he was a 2020 draft pick. So I'm willing to throw some of that stuff out there. Other one I'm going to throw out there too is one of my favorite players in the draft last year from the college side of things. That's Ryan Bliss, who was an undersized shortstop from Auburn. It's like my second time. I swear to God, I'm not like a Red Sox homer. It's the second time bringing up Dustin Pedroia. He reminds me of Pedroia. You watch, it's like this big right-handed swing. He swings from his shoes. You know, there's a ton of loft in the bat path, but he's got the ability to adjust and hit high fastballs. He had some of the best numbers I've seen in synergy over the last 3 years against fastballs 93 miles per hour or harder. So he can hit velocity. He's undersized, probably stretched a little bit in terms of range at shortstop, but he could be a tremendous second baseman. There's power there. He can run. There's approach. I'm a big Ryan Bliss guy. I know he took, you know, an underslot bonus in the second round, but I do think he's a guy that could overachieve and be, you know, an everyday second baseman with some offensive power there. So he's a guy that I think could take a big jump this year. He's outside, I think, probably a most, you know, top 300s and probably even some prospect, you know, 400, 500s. I have to look where I have him ranked personally. But I do think he could move into like the top 150, maybe the back end of a top 100, depending upon how well he performs this year. And he is a guy that saw, you know, a substantial amount of at-bats and full season ball at the end of last season. So, you know, I think that speaks to where the organization views him. All right, last question. I'll throw it over to James and over to Matt. We'll wrap this up. James, who's your most rostered prospect so far this season or even coming into the year?
For Dynasty, probably Dustin Harris. For Redraft, probably Cody Morris.
All right. I like that.
So, yeah, I mean, I kind of did a deep dive on Dustin Harris midway through last year. Was kind of fell in love with him and just was able to add him in pretty much every Dynasty league at that point. That was sort of before. You know, obviously the numbers were impressive, but I don't think people were really kind of taking him seriously at that point. So he was out there in all my leagues. And so have him pretty much everywhere. And then, Cody Morris, the more kind of dig in on his pitches and performance, I think people are really kind of sleeping on the fact that he is as good as almost any pitching prospect in the game.
Yeah, I know we've had that conversation offline. It's like, I think for Redraft, he's probably a top five or six pitching prospect just for, you know, guys that are kind of come up, have the opportunity to not only see innings, but ultimately being a really successful situation. And I think that Morris is a good one. But when I wrote this question, I said, James is going to say either Dustin Harris or Gavin Stone. So I got 50% there. And both prospects that are great. And I think, you know, you did a good job hitting on those guys. Matt, who's your most rostered prospect?
I have a lot of shares of Triantos, Jeremy Pena, Peyton Burdick, Vinny Pasquantino, guys like that. But you can't really get discounts on those guys in startups. I think where I go in that format is with a couple of DSL shortstops.
Yep.
Carlos Jorge of the Reds, very dynamic left-handed hitter with speed, chance for near average power. And Christian Santana of the Tigers, who has already shown very, very encouraging power output and has a manageable strikeout rate and is definitely going to be a player who could rise up boards this year.
Do you have both of those guys in your battle league?
I do, yes.
Nice. I was looking at my battle too, and that's where I pulled. I think my guy this year, it's probably like Oswaldo Cabrera or Aaron Zavala. I own a ton of both of those guys, and a lot of it was digging into the numbers on the hit tool side of things. And just looking at guys that like had good approach, had good contact skills, watching at bats and being like, all right, you know, these guys are identifying pitches. They're recognizing what's coming in. And they both have some raw power. Like some of the underlying, you know, exit data is really good when I dug in on both of them. So they're both guys that, you know, I have rostered all over the place. And then I think Josh Smith from Texas is another one. Just because I think that there's some way, shape, or form that he could potentially factor into that infield this year. After the Josh Young news, unfortunately, came about, got that. And then in redraft, it's Jeremy Pena. And I'm very nervous that Jeremy Pena, within a few hours, may not have a starting job to jump into like I had suspected. So silly me for, you know, expecting the Astros not to go out and get another shortstop. But yes, that's probably my most rostered guys. Anything else, Matt or James, you wanted to promote or mention here before we wrap the show up?
I don't really have much. I mean, if you're new to RotoWire, I mean, you can go get a free 10-day trial, rotowire.com/podcast, check out the rankings. I'll be doing a big update to the top 400. Prospect rankings and my dynasty rankings shortly before opening day. So keep an eye out for that. But, you know, other than that, just really appreciate you guys having me on.
Yeah, same here, man. It's always great to have you on. And, you know, you're somebody that is a colleague here in the industry, but also somebody I consider a friend and someone whose value I value greatly. Matt, also a friend and someone whose opinion I value greatly. Anything you want to throw out there or promote before we wrap this up?
We have our BA Dynasty 1000, you know, Google that. But I would also echo what James said. RotoWire subscription, well worth it. Make sure you check out the My Leagues feature so you can get a customizable. And Jeff actually hipped me to the My Leagues, so I was able to make use of it. Great feature.
I think it's one of the best features out there. You can plug your leagues in. You can search who's available in your leagues. So my thing is, and even if you're not going to follow James's rankings, you know, to the letter, it's really great to be able to look at it and look at the full board. And James does a great job of including all the right guys and just saying, all right, this guy's available. All right, who do I want? What fits best for my team? And it cuts back that whole, like, what used to be like that 20, 30, 40 minute period where you're searching through the, you know, you're searching through the waiver wire, you're looking at the player pool, who's available, who fits, and you're making a list on the side. It's like it cuts all that down. I think it's a great tool and I really appreciate that. And as I always say here, as we wrap this up, guys, remember this is fantasy baseball. Have some fun. Thanks for tuning in.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.